This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning and welcome to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanesan. Besides social distancing and vaccines, another tool in the fight against COVID-19 has been contact tracing, the process of identifying people who have come in contact with infected persons. And the hope here is that by tracing the contacts, that eventually we can test, isolate and treat the potentially infected to mitigate the spread in a given population. Now, with the COVID-19 pandemic, however, contact tracing has been modernized with the use of mobile apps, Bluetooth, Wi-Fi and GPS. While we take them for granted today, these were not as widely available in previous pandemics. So today on The Grill, I discuss the various systems currently in use and their efficacy, their privacy concerns that arise from all this, and what these systems could look like as COVID-19 becomes endemic. And to help me with this, I'm speaking with Susan Landau, Professor of Cybersecurity at America's Tufts University. Susan, welcome to The Breakfast Grill. Thank you for your time.
Thanks very much for having me.
Susan, I'm hoping we can start with the basics here and kind of just inform us of the different, because there are a variety of systems that I play across the world, whether it's Singapore's Trace Together or the system used in South Korea, or even the more decentralized systems we have over in the US, in the EU. Could you give us a little bit of the lay of the land of the various types of contact tracing apps and systems available and the underlying technologies they use?
Sure. So when the disease first appeared, people started thinking about using the kinds of distance measurements that the phones could do. The phones, of course, can do GPS to trace where we've been. They use Wi-Fi, so they can say which room they've been in, which space they've been in. And then they use Bluetooth, a short signal that allows your phone to act as a hotspot and so on. So GPS sounded attractive. But in fact, the disease spreads indoors, not outdoors, or at least almost entirely spreads indoors, not outdoors. Nonetheless, the South Koreans have been using GPS, and they've been using it in combination with CCTV and credit card receipts. And the way they do so is that when somebody tests positive, they trace where they've been, and then they use the CCTV records to see, has that person been in the ATM or other people wearing masks? This was early in the pandemic, so not everybody was wearing masks. Was the person only in there for a couple of minutes getting money? Then no problem. They were in a restaurant. Surely they didn't have masks on. There are other people sitting nearby in this restaurant, and you go to the proprietor, you get, in fact, quite quickly, the credit card receipts, and you do contact tracing that way. So that was using GPS as well as CCTV and credit card records. But GPS, as I mentioned, really works outdoors, and the disease spreads indoors. Wi-Fi turns out to be not that useful. You often don't know who is using your Wi-Fi signal and therefore can't figure out who is in close proximity. But Bluetooth is very tempting because the signal drops as people are distant from one another. If you put a set of identifiers on, let's say, your phone and my phone, and my phone takes these identifiers and sends them out, you know, sends one out for 15 minutes every few minutes. And if you and I are in close proximity, within 6 feet of each other, your phone picks it up and stores it. Later on, if I, for example, am diagnosed with COVID, if my identifier is on your phone, then you know that you've been, if you can find out somehow that I have been diagnosed as having COVID, then you can find out that you've been exposed. Now, how does that information exchange work? Well, there are a couple of different ways. Singapore did Trace Together and did it very early. What they did is when you download the Trace Together app, the identifiers that are on your phone are identifiers tied to your phone number. So your phone and my phone exchange identifiers. Maybe you are standing near me on a bus, maybe we're at the same conference and we're standing in the same room talking to different people, but we're quite close to each other. And then I'm diagnosed. And when I get called by a Singaporean Ministry of Health contact tracer, he asks me, do I have Trace Together on my phone? And I say, yes. He asks me to upload the identifiers I've collected. I upload those identifiers to him, the identifiers that I collected during the period in which I was contagious. And the Ministry of Health goes through and finds your identifier on there and informs you you've been exposed. That's called a centralized system because the Ministry of Health knows that you and I have been in close proximity. And it knows that it's you because the identifier is connected to your phone number and they can figure out who you are by the phone number. Both in Europe and in the United States, also in Australia, as Trace Together came out, epidemiologists, privacy activists, people working in cryptography were concerned about how such data might be used, knowing who is in close proximity to whom, tells you whether somebody is spending time with someone they shouldn't, maybe there's an extramarital affair going on. It tells you whose journalists' contacts are and so on. And so they said, can we do this in a decentralized way so that two people aren't, one person is informed they've been exposed without actually knowing who exposed them. And more importantly, nobody else knows the two people have been in close proximity. So again, you and I have an app on the phone and we're exchanging identifiers. But now when you're diagnosed with COVID and you talk to a contact tracer or the public health actually, public health will say to you, well, do you have an app on the phone? And you say yes, or maybe you don't even have to talk to a contact tracer. You can actually just upload. You have the app on your phone. You prove that you've actually been diagnosed. So you actually, in order not to spoof the whole system, you have something that you get from public health that says you have been diagnosed. And then you upload your identifiers, the identifiers your phone sent out while you were contagious. My phone goes to the public health server a few times a day. One day, it picks up an identifier that I happen to have on my phone because I was in close proximity to you at a time when you were contagious. And my phone says to me, you've been exposed. I know I've been exposed because I collected the identifier that was already on the phone from when I was near you. But nobody else knows that I had that identifier on my phone. So public health doesn't learn that you and I have been in close proximity. And when you provide your identifiers to public health, you're only telling public health that you have been diagnosed with having COVID, but public health already knew that. So there's no information that you're sharing that wasn't already in public. So that's a privacy-preserving technique of doing exposure notification.
This brings to mind the fact that I think it was April 2020 that Google and Apple announced that they had a partnership, that they would work together to build an exposure notification system that governments can utilize in their own apps and systems and things like that. How does this, I think it's known as the GAIN system or now EN Express, how does that fit into the contact tracing ecosystem as it is today?
The exposure notification system, what Apple and Google did is they took their underlying technology. So both sets of phones, both Androids and iPhones, send out Bluetooth signals. But Bluetooth signals can be expensive if you're sending them out all the time. And Apple, in part to conserve battery use, would not send out Bluetooth signals to anything that was not an Apple device. So it would send it out to an Apple device, like an Apple Watch from an iPhone, but it would not send it out regularly to any non-Apple device if the app wasn't being used at that moment. So think about somebody commuting on a bus. What do they want to do? They don't want to be running the app. They want to be reading. They want to be doing a crossword puzzle. They want to be playing with Facebook. Whatever it is they want to be doing, they don't want to be just running the app. So the app is supposed to be in background. Well, then that wasn't going to work. That is, the iPhone app would only work with other iPhone apps. So that was one problem to be fixed. The other problem is both Apple and Android wanted to be sure that the sending out of signal and the listening for signal didn't use too much battery. So they had to work together to figure out a way, or actually not figure out a way, the way was relatively obvious, but to implement the way so that it worked together well. So they built that infrastructure and all the apps, whether you're talking European apps or the apps in the various states in the United States, the Bermuda app, they all work on top of this Google Apple infrastructure. First one was the one you mentioned, GAIN, Google Apple Exposure Notification. And then Google Apple created something called EN Express, which is essentially a checklist. How far apart should the people be for your app? How long do they need to be exposed for your app? Do you want a logo? And so on.
Now, of course, all this brings to mind privacy concerns, which we will get into in a little bit. But I just want, maybe before we move on, if you could summarize essentially the pros and cons between the centralized system we're seeing in a lot of Asian countries versus the decentralized system we're seeing in the likes of the US or the EU, that sort of situation.
Right. So it comes down to lots and lots of social choices. The development of the GAIN system came about because of lots of concern of what would governments do with the information. Knowing somebody's location, which tells you a lot about them. So location is very revealing of people's behavior, but so is proximity. And so it was important to, as I said, the cryptographers, the privacy folks, the epidemiologists, to develop a decentralized system. The South Korean system is interesting. South Korea had a bad problem with MERS, Middle East Respiratory Syndrome. And so one thing they did is revamped some of their testing protocols of medical equipment so that in an emergency they could speed up how they would approve things. The other thing they did is they went and amended their privacy law. So in the case of a medical emergency, they could get access to the data I mentioned of GPS, that is, the government could get quick access to GPS and credit card and CCTV information during the time of the medical emergency. But the decision about what information to collect was a decision made by South Korea during a time when it wasn't an emergency. They had a long considered discussion of how they would handle it during an emergency, which is, of course, how you want to discuss and decide about how to handle privacy, security, public health. You don't want to do it in the midst of an emergency. You want to do it well before.
And I think that's the key thing, right? Because some of us may assume that it was done in response to this current pandemic, but this was all after MERS, which was in 2015, if I'm not mistaken. So it wasn't reactionary. It was proactive based on a previous event there. I was speaking with Susan Landau, Professor of Cybersecurity at America's Tufts University, and you've been listening to The Breakfast Grill. Keep it here to BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Karnison. This morning, I'm speaking with Susan Landau, Professor of Cybersecurity at America's Tufts University. So, Susan, may we take a look at the current systems around the world? A lot of this is based on technologies to gauge proximity and location, whether it's Wi-Fi, Bluetooth, or even GPS. But their accuracy, I mean, as the example you gave earlier with Bluetooth, right, that your husband is connected to your mouse and there was a little bit of a confusion there. Are these essentially blunt instruments, or will the data over time, overcome those limitations?
So we don't know. There was a study done in Dublin in which the phone apps were used within a tram car. And as people got further apart, the signal diminished and the apps worked in the right way. Till they got to the metal part that joins two tram cars together. And then the signal didn't diminish. It did when it was hitting the glass windows as the people were getting further apart. But when they got to the metal piece between the two, it didn't diminish. You have those sorts of problems. It matters whether the house you're in is wood framed, like my house is. If you have cement block, the signal doesn't go through as well. So people in two apartments will not get exposure notifications. The state of Virginia warned students in dorms that they might get an exposure notification from somebody in the next room, even though that person was not exiting the room while they were ill. So there's that kind of problem. The signal varies with whether the phone is in your front pocket, your back pocket, or for women, in their handbag. So there are going to be those kinds of problems.
I do want to talk a little bit about privacy concerns, right? Because essentially we're seeing troves of data being collected in amongst all this. And as we mentioned earlier, we saw Apple and Google work together on a system. These two phone makers and operating system providers essentially are 90% of the smartphone market. Wouldn't this cause concerns over surveillance and privacy for their users? Because on one side, I would assume those who would mistrust the government may trust private corporations more, but nonetheless, this is a lot of data in the hands of two companies.
Yes. The companies don't get the data. The data resides on the phones and it doesn't go anywhere else. But two, there are many people who have historic distrust of the government, historic distrust of surveillance. I have a good friend whose family member was interned in the Japanese-American internment camps during the Second World War. These camps, for your listeners who don't know it, Japanese-American citizens were in internment camps because of fear of a fifth column. And my friend's mother, years after the war, would not give out personal information unless it was absolutely necessary. So there are people who have historic reasons for not wanting to provide information.
And Susan, when you say something like the companies don't get the data, it stays on the phone. But I personally know a lot of skeptics that might not trust that. Look, is there anything you could say to help maybe assuage their fears?
So in answer to your question, the data is on the phone. Can somebody go onto the phone and get data off the phone? Yes, we know of, for example, the NSO group, which does that exactly that sort of thing. And there are other kinds of spying organizations that can get data off the phone. That's probably not the question you're asking. The question you're asking is, could Google or Apple have access to that data? Well, Google and Apple have made very public statements about how their infrastructure works. And it's a large enough project that there are people at both companies, a number of people at both companies working on it. If Google and Apple had secret ways of getting data off the phone, we'd very quickly know about it because not everybody would be sworn to secrecy. This is not a national security kind of piece of software. This is a piece of software by a commercial company making public statements about how it operates. The same thing is true for the apps. The other part of it is that Google and Apple have requirements on the apps, like you can't get location. You can't work with an app that gets location and have the two together. So fairly stringent requirements. Those stringent requirements sometimes work against public health. So in early use of the app, when we didn't understand quite how the disease was spreading, we couldn't get information from the app on that because it wouldn't say there was a super spreading incident at location A because you didn't know where these people had been. You only knew that a large number of people had become infected. Maybe they would tell you during contact tracing and you could figure it out, but that would take time. So the answer to your question of what do you do with people who say, I don't trust the apps, I don't trust the government, I don't trust Google and Apple, with enough distrust, it's very hard to get past that. I happen to be quite concerned with privacy, and there are many things I don't do. I was a very late consumer of smartphones and a late consumer of even a cell phone. And I don't give my smartphone number out because it's hard to reach me because it's often in another room or left at home when I'm out. Not because I'm trying to be private, but because I really don't care to be reachable all the time. I'm private in that way. So giving you a small slice of my personality, I'm saying I'm not worried about the apps because there's too much public viewing of what's going on that I don't think that that's an issue. That said, Singapore's Trace Together, the data does reside with the government, and the government has used it for other purposes, including criminal investigations.
So you've beat me to the punch there, Susan, because I was going to now switch the conversation over to governments purely because, I mean, one example earlier was South Korea amending laws to remove some privacy protections in the event of a health emergency for the duration of that health emergency. But again, overall, this, again, brings to light the roads over the concerns over privacy and civil liberties. And as you noted as well, Singapore started using some of that data for law enforcement concerns. From a cybersecurity perspective here, where do you see the balance between public safety and privacy of the individual?
So that's a huge question that we could spend the rest of your audience's day and week discussing. I don't think of public safety and privacy as being on the opposite side. I work a lot in the encryption debate, and we often hear of it phrased as privacy versus security. You don't want me to go through the three reports I've worked on and the three books I've written on the subject. So let me just say briefly that in that debate, when you protect people's data and you protect people's communications, you're securing them. So yes, you're securing criminals, but you're also securing all the non-criminals, all the rest of the people who are not committing criminal acts. And so you've really got there in that debate, you've got a conflict between efficiency of doing criminal investigations and public safety, national security, because you're protecting people's data, you're protecting business data, you're protecting national security. So it's really a security versus security argument. Here we're talking about public health, public safety, people's privacy. I come from a country where getting people to wear masks, not my part of the country, but my country, where getting people to wear masks is really hard. And that's known to be efficacious, and you're not giving up any data. And that's why it should be part of a whole public health solution. Is the data kept private, that is used only for public health? Is there financial support for people who have to stay home and not go to work? What do we do about different communities? I can't speak there about Malaysia, but I can speak in the United States where different communities, whether you're talking about the Latinx community or the Black community or the Native American community, live in very different ways, have different histories of interaction with the government and different levels of trust or distrust in public health and in the government. With that, you want to have different solutions for these different communities. And you also want to know, how well do the apps work in these communities? If the apps are not working well in one of the communities, because the community has a historic distrust of the government and maybe of public health, but it's working well in another community and they're getting more medical resources, that's great because you're decreasing the number of infections in the country as a whole. But it does mean you have to devote more resources to the community that isn't using the apps. So that says the apps are a potentially useful tool, but they need to be thought of as part of a full public health solution and not the apps in and of themselves.
Susan, with the last few minutes we have, we've seen the evolution of cyber warfare over the last few years, and most recently, big examples like of ransomware and things like that. With all this data being collected, are you concerned over, I guess, data breaches or cyber hacking, especially from state actors and things like that? Is that something that is on the forefront of your mind, or is that something that we need to deal with later on?
Well, the decentralized apps, the ones using the Google Apple infrastructure and ones that are decentralized that are not, although I'm not aware of any of those, but the decentralized apps, the data's on the phone. If someone gets arrested and their phone is part of the evidence that, you know, is grabbed when they're grabbed, then yes, the phone is picking up that information. But that's a kind of, that's an extreme situation. The fact is, for everybody else, the phone, the data of proximity is only on their phones. For centralized apps, the data is at the government and it becomes a rich source for the government and potentially for other actors. So would I be worried if the United States moved to a centralized app? I'd be worried, sure, about could it be misused by my government, but I'd also be worried about who else is going to use that. What happens when a student from abroad is going to student movements in the United States that their government doesn't like? Their government gets access to that data, or we can think of many other examples. So yes, this is a real rich treasure trove. It's an argument for not collecting the data in the first place if you're worried that somebody might go after you.
Susan, I'd like to thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much for having me.
I was speaking with Susan Landau, Professor of Cybersecurity at America's Tufts University, and you've been listening to The Breakfast Grill. I'm Roshan Kanasan for BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.